Welcome to KGNU's Morning Magazine. It is Monday, June 12th of 2023. I'm your host, Jimmy Searfoss. Coming up on today's show, many people take up hiking to soak up the sights, but we'll hear from someone who treks up canyons for the sounds. Then, what's behind all those We Buy Ugly Houses signs and billboards? CityCast Denver sits down with ProPublica reporter who dug into that very question. After the BBC news headlines, we'll hear from the latest commentary from Jim Hightower. And today's A Public Affair, Boulder-based podcaster Lori McGraw will be in to share an episode of her Inspiring Women series. Today's episode features the head of Girl Scouts of Colorado. At 9 a.m., it's Counterspin, a look at fairness and accuracy in reporting. And after that, Leland Rucker will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. That's all coming up, but first, headlines from KGNU's Stacey Johnson.
A Denver District Court judge has ordered the school board of Denver Public Schools to release the entire recording of a closed-door meeting in which they decided to allow armed police to return to schools. Six Colorado news outlets sued the school board, alleging the March meeting violated Colorado's open meetings law. School board members met in a closed-door session for 5 hours on March 23rd in the wake of gun violence incidents that occurred at East High. Just days before the closed-door session, an East High student shot two faculty members and later took his own life. Weeks earlier, another student died from gunshot wounds after he was shot in his car outside of the school. During the closed meeting, the board adopted a temporary policy of bringing armed police officers back to the district schools. Earlier this month, the board, by a vote of 4-3, voted to keep the policy in place. Judge Andrew Luxon ruled that the board members did engage in substantial discussion of topics requiring public view, and the board failed to provide public notice of their closed meeting. A district spokesperson told Colorado Newsline the school district plans on appealing the judge's decision. The former superintendent of Aurora Public Schools has lodged a formal complaint against the Aurora School Board, alleging racial bias was behind his discharge. Kira Zizzo has more.
In a complaint filed earlier this month, Rico Munn, the district's first black superintendent, alleges he faced criticism from two black school board members for not being, quote, black enough, and for not prioritizing the hiring of black employees over other people of color. According to the Aurora Sentinel, an external investigator's report substantiated Munn's claims and found racial bias in the decision to not renew his contract. The investigator's decision also sanctioned two board members, Stephanie Mason and Tremaine Duncan, for unlawful race discrimination. The report also highlighted that certain influential board members held discriminatory beliefs about Munn's so-called failure of conformity to racial stereotypes, leading to his discharge. The decision letter recommended reprimanding and censuring Mason and Duncan, and mandated equal opportunity training for all board members. Munn stepped down as the superintendent at the end of 2022, and his contract expires at the end of this month. Michael Giles, the current assistant superintendent of Equity, Culture, and Community Engagement at the Cherry Creek School District, will assume the role of the next Aurora Public School superintendent. For KGNU, I'm Kira Zizzo.
Boulder Valley School District agreed last week to settle a discrimination lawsuit started by a white family who alleged the district mishandled bullying reports against their 9-year-old son who attended Whittier Elementary in Boulder. As part of the settlement, BVSD agreed to pay the family $32,500 and remove the bullying investigation from the boys' records, while the family agreed to dismiss all claims. District officials said in a written statement that the settlement was not an easy decision, as BVSD maintains it did nothing wrong and denies the family's claims, but said the settlement will enable the school to start the new school year without the specter of litigation. According to the Daily Camera, the family began their lawsuit in federal court after the principal determined that the plaintiff's son racially harassed two black classmates. The parents of the boy say their son was physically attacked. In a statement in social media, the mother of one of the classmates criticized the settlement by saying the district's decision shows that white families can use the legal system to harass black, indigenous, and Latino families and get paid for it. Unionized Starbucks workers at stores in Littleton and Superior joined a nationwide unfair labor practice strike yesterday by demanding that Starbucks negotiate a fair contract. Strike organizers allege the company is continuing its union-busting campaign that includes threatening worker access to benefits and refusing to put Pride decor up at dozens of stores across the country during Pride Month. According to Workers United, since 2021, more than 300 Starbucks stores have voted to unionize, but none have reached a collective bargaining agreement with the company. Among the decisions by the National Labor Relations Board, the agency's judges have found that the company has broken numerous labor laws, including firing pro-union workers and threatening to rescind benefits if employees organize. Company officials have repeatedly denied allegations by the unionized workers. RTD is bringing back and expanding its Zero Fare for Better Air program, and Boulder County is building upon it. KGNU's Poor John Jenkett has more.
Passengers will be able to ride RTD buses and light rail routes for free during July and August. The goal of the Zero Fare for Better Air campaign is to encourage new riders and limit ozone air pollution during the months when air quality is at its lowest. RTD piloted the program in August of last year. Starting July 5th, Boulder County will also expand its ride-free Lafayette and the Lions Flyer services. According to the Denver Post, RTD continues to struggle to find enough operators for both trains and buses. The shortage, in smaller capacity, extends to other departments in RTD. Funding for the Free Fare Initiative comes from grants authorized through state legislation passed in 2022. For KGNU, I'm Poor Jai Chunkett.
For today's weather, the National Weather Service predicts skies will be sunny with highs in the upper 80s and the low 90s. Winds could gust as high as 18 miles per hour. Tonight, skies will be mostly clear with lows in the upper 50s. Tonight's winds could gust as high as 22 miles per hour. For KGNU, I'm Stacey Johnson.
Listening to the Morning Magazine here on KGNU, I'm your host, Jimmy Searfoss. Some people take trekking poles up to the when they go on hikes. Jeff Gutierrez takes a saxophone, and he has created a business that gives musical tours of Moab's canyons. KZMU's Emily Arnston attended one of those musical hikes and talked to Gutierrez about how he uses the landscape as an instrument.
It's a perfect match of stuff for me. It's like all my passions, music, sharing wilderness with other people.
He took me out yesterday, and at the very beginning of the hike, we got a little surprise echo sound check.
That is amazing.
Do you hear
that? Something fell. That was definitely a rock fall.
Wow.
Dang. Where did it fall?
Hard to tell. I bet we'll see some dust.
Is that good luck or bad luck?
Yeah, the best.
What kind of music do you play when you take people on these tours?
You know, sometimes I'll play songs, but the coolest thing about playing out here is hearing all the echoes bouncing back. And so I play very differently out here than I would with a band at Woody's or something like that.
What is it about the echoes that you like?
I feel like a bat, like some kind of sonar animal, and you can hear the shape of the canyon, and you can hear these notes just like bubbling around through the corners and through the twists and bends of these canyons. Makes the instrument feel so much larger. It feels like the canyon is the instrument. At least that's the kind of mind frame that I try to get in. Like, you know, on the saxophone, it's this brass instrument with this wooden reed. And so the reed is the thing that's vibrating and that's making the actual sound. And then the instrument is amplifying that and broadcasting it out way more than just that little reed could do on its own. And so I try to think of myself playing as the saxophone player, like I'm that reed, and this canyon is the instrument.
What is it about the saxophone that you like?
I at this point, it feels natural to me. It feels like my voice, feels like my singing voice. And I love how expressive it can be. Really conveys a lot of emotion. It can be loud, it can be really soft, it can sound like it's wailing. I think when I was young and first starting off, one of the things that drew me to it was just the look of it. You know, it's shiny, it's all curvy. This is my little guy. This is an alto saxophone. It's kind of my beater horn, you know, it's not the fanciest of saxophones. And so it's small, it's portable, works well on a hike just like this.
Before he started playing, he asked everyone to tune their ears to the sounds that were already happening around them.
You know, so many different sound sources are out there right now. It's the obvious one, there's the plane. But what other sounds are you hearing in this canyon, I thought?
Birds,
yep. What else we got?
Crickets.
Mosquito, bee.
Yep. Some wind every once in a while. And so just like a symphony, you know, you've got sounds that happen throughout the whole time. Sometimes that's like a percussion section or something playing a repetitive drum beat. Out here, I hear that as like the wind, you know, even the airplanes, insects buzzing around.
So do you know what you're going to play already?
Nope. Be mostly improvising. You know, sometimes on the hike, if music comes up in conversation or something like that, and if somebody mentions some specific song, especially that I know, I'll try to, you know, take a mental note about that and throw it in there sometime. When I'm playing, I'm really listening closely to what's going on too and trying to fit inside of it. And sometimes I even like getting a little, you know, back and forth. I like to think of it as a conversation with like a raven or something like that. And I'm going to try to talk to him if I get him talking. Melody out, and then I'll stop and listen for the echoes and how they're bouncing back. And usually there's just this natural syncopated rhythm that bounces back. So you can just play one note, bop, and then off in the distance from these different directions you hear bop, 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 something like that. And then the really fun challenge is grooving with it. And so there's like this natural groove or like little rhythmic figure that is naturally in the soundscape here, and to try to find ways to play around with that and groove with it and be in the same tempo and you know, like jump on top of it sometimes, so it's almost like you're playing harmony with yourself. That's a really fun challenge.
For KZMU, I'm Emily Ernson.
Have you ever seen one of those signs that says, "We buy ugly houses," stapled on a telephone pole or maybe plastered on giant block letters on a billboard? Do you ever wonder what happens when someone actually calls that number? ProPublica investigative reporter Anjanette Damon cracked the story wide open. She spoke with CityCast Denver's host, Bree Davies, about how the mysterious HomeVestors business model works and how they scoop up so many deeds to so many perfectly good-looking houses. And most importantly, who's paying the price?
We found that this company, the way the company advertises, and they spend an insane amount of money on advertising. So that's why you've seen these billboards. That's why you get these letters in your mailbox. But that advertising often catches people in the net who are in very vulnerable situations. And it's almost, you know, it could be analogous to like a payday loan kind of thing. I need money fast to help me out of this situation. The company teaches franchises to, quote unquote, find the pain, and they leverage that pain to get a contract. And, you know, payday loans can be very difficult and put people in a lot of difficult financial situations. Here we're talking about a home, which is the largest investment most people have in their entire lifetimes.
And Jeanette, can you tell me the story of Corrine Casanova?
Yeah, so Corrine Casanova and her husband bought a 3-bedroom small house in a Los Angeles suburb way back in 1961. They raised a family, raised 3 kids there. Unfortunately, Corrine's husband passed away before she did, and her health started to decline. She started suffering from dementia, and her kids figured it was time for her to move to a place where she could get more care. And so she was days away from moving into assisted living. And for some reason, we're not sure why, it occurred to her that she might have to sell her house. And so she had a letter that had come in her mailbox sometime in the past. She called the number and said, "Hey, I'm moving into an assisted living facility. Could you give me an estimate of the value of my house?" She had reached a company called Homevestors, and they sent a man named Corey Evans out to her house. He was there the next day. Within just a short period of time, he had convinced her to sign a contract to sell her house for a price about 60% of what it was worth.
Wow.
Remember, she had pretty well-documented dementia. Her kids said that she had maybe about a 3-minute memory. She would mistake her adult son as her brother all the time, and they just kind of went along with it, you know. They had no idea she had signed this contract to sell the house. And sadly, she passed away about 19 days after she signed the contract. And that's when they discovered what had happened. Corey Evans sent a handwritten note to her house after she had died saying, "Hey, we're closing. Where are you?" When her son David found the letter, he's like, "Look, we're not selling this house. My mom had dementia. She didn't know what she was signing. You know, we need to drop all of this." Instead of, you know, letting that family walk away, this company, it was a franchise of Homevestors named Patriot Holdings. They sued the Casanova family to hold them to the deal, engaging them in a 4 or 5 year legal battle that continues today.
We all get these letters in the mail if we own a home. "You want to sell your house?" She has dementia. She calls them and says, "I have dementia." That should be a signal to a real estate person, like, oh boy, let's get somebody else involved here. But that's what I want to know is, like, why did this company go through with this knowing this about her?
I should say that in their legal filings, Corey Evans maintained throughout that he noticed no signs of impairment or dementia. We do have a transcript of that phone call. She didn't outright say, "Hey, I have dementia." But, you know, she was elderly. She was by herself. She was moving into assisted living. Her family took all the steps they thought that they could. The house was in a trust, so she legally couldn't sign it over anyway. They had installed cameras to keep her safe, and still this happened. So it's a really difficult thing to protect against. And I think the motivating factor for these companies are just get the contract signed. Maybe there's clues that there's dementia. Maybe there's clues that there's a power of attorney out there. Maybe there's clues that that it's in a trust. And we found multiple examples of Homevestors franchises kind of ignoring those clues, getting a contract signed, and then going forward with a legal battle. Maybe they don't end up with the property, but in other cases, we've seen them get 10, 15 grand, even more money just to settle, to walk away from the contract that they got signed.
So this situation with Corrine Casanova, as you said, happened in Los Angeles, in the Los Angeles area, but Homevestors is a franchise. Like, so they operate all over the country. Most folks will be aware of them because they advertise with these billboards that have a caveman on them that say, "We buy ugly houses." Tell me exactly, who is Homevestors? Who is this company behind We Buy Ugly Houses?
So it was started in the late 90s by a Texas real estate investor. And they kind of formalized this process for flipping houses. And it's evolved. This entire industry has evolved over the years. But HomeBusters has grown into quite a behemoth. They probably make more of their money signing up franchises, just like a McDonald's or a Subway. So they operate franchises operate in 48 states. There's about 1,100 of them. And HomeBusters teaches this process for how to take a call, go to the house quickly, talk the person into signing the contract, and then sometimes they'll sell that contract. As I said, it's evolved and it's pretty complicated. So sometimes they won't even take ownership of the house. They'll just sell the contract to another investor who buys the contract and thus the house. Sometimes they'll fix it up and flip it. Sometimes they'll maintain it and they'll rent it out. So there's various exit strategies.
So you and your fellow reporters, the reporting that you did focused on this one company, HomeBusters, which operates franchises all over the country. Anjanette, how prevalent is this problem?
It's prevalent. HomeBusters is not the only actor out there. You know, this conversation kind of started and our reporting started by wondering who is behind the sign on the telephone pole. There are so many iterations of house flippers out there. We ended up focusing on HomeBusters. They're self-proclaimed the largest cash home buyer in the country because they kind of developed this system, because they trained franchises all over the country. We said, well, let's look at this. But just go on YouTube, just go on Instagram, just Google anything about, you know, get rich quick on real estate. And you have, rather than franchises, you have these gurus that are selling systems. And yeah, they're really popular in hot markets. Phoenix, Florida, North Carolina, Atlanta, all of these markets that you think of as hot housing markets where homes are going quickly, they're operating. Denver as well.
Denver is a hot market. Like I joke, you can like sell a half burned down house here for $1 million in the right neighborhood, but they still operate here. I still see their signs and I still see iterations of these other companies. So there is still a way for them to make money, even when the market is competitive. And it sounds like in part because it's such a complicated thing that a lot of homeowners don't fully understand.
They have the brand in their head, the We Buy Ugly Houses in their head. They have the letter. The letter literally said, while I was doing this reporting, I literally got a HomeBusters letter. and it's stamped right there in red. Keep this letter with your important house papers. Right. So you get this in the mail and you're older and then here comes the time.
You think it's important.
Yeah. Here's this letter. Why don't I call this number and see what happens?
I know that you reached out to HomeBusters, I'm sure for an interview or a comment, but I wonder what was their reaction to your investigation?
We requested several times an interview with the CEO, David Hicks. He declined our offer. They engaged a kind of a reputation management PR company. And to their credit, they answered our questions. We sent them several rounds. It's our practice at ProPublica never to surprise anybody who's the subject of a story. So even if they decline interviews with us, we send them a summary of what our reporting has found and said, you know, finding number one, this is what we found. Do you have anything to say about this? Here's a question for you. And HomeBusters PR representative provided answers. Sometimes they didn't exactly answer the question, but they did sure provide answers to all of our questions. And again, their response was that we looked at a small number of transactions and that they have a 96% customer satisfaction rating. They, again, denied that they target anybody in any kind of socioeconomic condition or age or race or particular, they're targeting the house. But shortly after we sent that letter, our first letter, we got wind that they had held a conference call with all of their franchises to warn them that this story was coming out, and we were able to obtain a recording of that webinar, which was, you know, one of the first times I've been able to see in real time how a company reacts to my reporting before the story even came out.
When this article comes out, I want to encourage you, please don't click on it. We will go post the article on the internet. We'll post other articles where they've been printed so you can see them. But if you click on it, you will drive the error up on the SEO.
And in that call, you know, they said one of the franchises asked, well, are they making up information? And the company was like, no, they have good information. They actually did good reporting. They dug in areas we never would have expected them to dig.
Overall, we're going to change some of our practices and make sure we change our systems and standards to make sure that we have our franchise doing the right thing.
Well, Antoinette Damon, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And that is all for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Jimmy Searfoss. Special thanks to Stacey Johnson, Alexis Kenyon, Kira Zizzo, Poor Jane Jonjit, Emily Arston, Shannon Young, and CityCast Denver crew for the work on today's show. If you'd like to comment on something you heard here on KGNU, you can leave us a voicemail at 303-447-9911. And we played back the messages on Tuesday for Morning Magazine. Stay tuned for a commentary from Jim Hightower. That's just the news headlines. And then after that is the news headlines from the BBC.